Today is Thursday, December 10th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the western U.S. state of California battles rising COVID-19 cases.
Under the new order, restaurants must close their outdoor dining area and only serve delivery and takeout orders.
Also ahead, a look at the latest in the Ethiopia-Tigray conflict.
Yeah, we have an ongoing conflict situation, and we have a situation where the federal government has taken control in some regards, but also still has other military objectives.
Plus, scientists may have discovered a new species of whale in Mexico. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is the COVID-19 outbreak in the U.S. The U.S. has experienced its deadliest day yet in the COVID-19 pandemic, with 3,124 reported fatalities Wednesday by Johns Hopkins University. But public health officials are struggling to contain the virus amid a widespread anti-mask movement and lack of economic relief for businesses and workers. California, the most populated state in the U.S., averaged over 26,200 cases and 143 deaths each day in the last week. The surge has prompted the governor to issue a regional stay-at-home order, but some businesses say the lockdown is unfair, as VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
Signs are everywhere that life in California is again under lockdown. Either by state or local mandate, some of California's most populated regions are under a stay-at-home order, this time through the Christmas holiday. This man, who only gives his first name as Joe, is getting takeout from a restaurant in Northern California.
It's not about me. It's about them. I feel bad for them.
Under the new order, restaurants must close their outdoor dining area and only serve delivery and takeout orders. Some restaurant owners are saying no. Andrew Gruhl is the owner and chef of Slapfish Restaurants Group.
We're not going to abide by those orders. We cannot survive with takeout and delivery alone because we're giving 30 cents on every dollar through delivery up to the Silicon Valley apps.
Many small business owners say this stay-at-home order is unfair. Retail stores can still operate indoors at 20% capacity, and the entertainment industry can continue. But nail and hair salons cannot. Barber Lou Garcia Reynoso received training to maintain a sanitary space and had complied with two shutdown orders since March, but not this time.
It's not because we don't think it's real. We want to take all the necessary precautions. We want to do all of those things. But when we see big business continuing to be able to work, even though their people don't have the training that we do, it makes it a little bit difficult for us to continue to comply.
Some business owners say it's also hard to follow orders from Governor Gavin Newsom when in November he attended a birthday dinner with a group of people after telling Californians not to have large gatherings. Again, Andrew Gruhl.
People who are writing the rules are breaking them themselves, and that tells us two things. Number one, that they don't care about us, and or number two, that they don't care about the rules or that things aren't serious enough for them to feel as if they should be following the rules.
Governor Gavin Newsom later apologized.
Well, I want to apologize to you because I need to preach and practice, not just preach and not practice.
The California governor says the sharp increase in hospitalizations, stretching resources, is the reason why so many Californians need to stay home. California's stay-at-home mandate lasts at least 3 weeks and begins in any of the five regions in the state when hospital intensive care unit capacity drops below 15%. Russell Bohr is a pulmonary and critical care physician at UCLA Health.
The problem is we don't have enough staff to take care of everyone. And that's really when things get dangerous in a hospital, is when we don't have enough staff to care for everyone who is very ill.
Lester Friedman is the mayor of Beverly Hills.
I think everybody needs to observe and obey all laws. I think that there are repercussions that could occur, certainly for the restaurants and really anybody who's licensed to do work by any state agency or county agency, that if they defy the laws, then their business licenses can be taken away.
But law enforcement officials in several Southern California counties say they will not be enforcing the stay-at-home order. Chad Bianco is the Riverside County Sheriff in Southern California.
The Riverside County Sheriff's Department will not be blackmailed, bullied, or used as muscle against Riverside County residents in the enforcement of the governor's orders.
As small businesses anticipate the economic fallout from the lockdown, doctors are bracing for what the Christmas holiday will bring. Governor Newsom says he does not anticipate another wave of COVID to hit the state because vaccines are on the way. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
It's been nearly 2 weeks since Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed claimed an end to military operations in the northern Tigray region, but reports this week say fighting continues amid allegations of human rights abuses and of Eritrea's alleged involvement in the conflict. Meanwhile, the United Nations and aid groups still do not have access to the strife-filled region. For analysis of the situation, I reached out to William Davison, who is a senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group. William, thank you so much for joining us. How are you today?
Yeah, good, thanks.
All right, let's jump right into it. William, it's been almost 2 weeks since the Prime Minister said that military operations would cease, but that doesn't appear to be the case on the ground. What's the latest?
Yes, I think what we saw there was obviously, you know, a very significant moment, the capture of the regional capital, and therefore, you know, the Tigrayan government or former government, you know, becoming a rebel movement. But that didn't mean that all of those leadership, you know, from Tigray who are wanted by the federal government for various crimes, they are still at large. And so there is very much still the federal objective, to capture them and bring them to justice. So, you know, since that announcement, from the Prime Minister, we've seen fairly heavy fighting in areas, particularly sort of to the west of the capital, Mekelle, and also sort of south of Adwa. And that's in the region, sort of mountainous region, where the leadership is believed to be. So possibly we're seeing fighting sort of along, you know, major engagements along you know, main roads where there are exits into the mountainous areas where the leadership is. And then I've also received information that there has been fairly heavy bombardment of, you know, probably more rural areas where the leadership has been based as well.
There have also been numerous allegations that have emerged over the past week about the involvement of Eritrean forces. How confirmed is that? How much involvement has there been by Eritrean forces crossing into Tigray to fight?
Well, what we really have is still clearly official denials, you know, from Asmara and from Addis Ababa, and then these very consistent allegations of heavy involvement from the Tigrayan side. And then I think, you know, from other sources, what we have is the sort of piling up of anecdotal evidence. You know, so some stuff from diplomats, from foreign governments, you know, saying that they've been using satellite imagery, plotting the involvement of Eritreans. Also sort of first-hand accounts from the ground, you know, some of them filtering through indirectly. So like I say, the anecdotal evidence is stacking up. But maybe, you know, we could also say there isn't that real smoking gun in terms of concrete evidence. And it's still a question of, you know, claim and counterclaim, from the parties directly involved about the Eritrean involvement.
Yeah. And one of the big challenges here to really understand or know what is happening is access to Tigray remains mostly cut off. Abiy said that aid would flow in after the capture of Mekelle, and the UN has had an agreement to move in, but it appears that really hasn't transpired.
Well, what we have, you know, in line with, you know, the first exchange, you know, we have an ongoing conflict situation, and we have, you know, a situation where the federal government has taken control in some regards, but also still has other military objectives. Now, this also translates into the situation with regards to media access and humanitarian access. There is a very little bit of media access going on, particularly in areas that the federal government controls. The UN, and therefore the humanitarian world, has an agreement with the federal government to deliver aid, but only in the areas that the federal government controls. Now, clearly, that isn't all of Tigray at the moment. So really, it's a question of, you know, how is the conflict going to develop? Because that will depend on how the federal government, what sort of access it allows to journalists and the aid agencies.
That's William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group. William, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Jason. Speak to you soon.
Next, we go to Egypt. When 22-year-old student Nadine Ashraf started an anonymous blog to expose sexual harassment in her inner circles, she never knew it would spark Egypt's Me Too movement. Emma McCarthy of Reuters explains.
When Cairo student Nadine Ashraf started an anonymous blog to expose sexual harassment in her inner circles, the 22-year-old never knew it would spark Egypt's Me Too movement. She's been selected as part of the BBC's 100 Women of 2020. So far, she's exposed two high-profile sexual harassment incidents, and her blog is now a voice for hundreds of women across Egypt, a country in which, in 2013, a United Nations survey suggested 99% of women experienced harassment.
I had this idea. I am a student. I don't have a voice in the media. I cannot change legislation. So the first thing I thought about is social media. I wanted to express myself and have my voice heard by the people. I wanted to expose someone who I know had committed the crime of sexual harassment. And I knew this to be a crime and something is wrong. But no one was talking about it, as everyone believes it to be a shame to talk about this. And we should not talk about this in our Arab society. I was so tired and annoyed and refused that this had been happening every day for years. And I had to do something about it.
Ashraf's first case was when she anonymously exposed a student from a wealthy background, Ahmed Bassam Zaki, who was later jailed and is currently on trial for sexual assault. That case prompted the government to approve a bill to better protect the identities of victims of sexual assault to encourage them to come forward. But when she later published a second high-profile case, she received death threats and had to suspend the account for weeks, only to later reopen it and reveal her identity. Her campaign isn't just about exposing injustice, however. She's also trying to foster discussions about the importance of consent and other issues related to gender-based violence.
The problem is bigger than one person, one crime, an incident. It is even bigger than 10 incidents. The problem is about the way we look at women. We never take crimes against women seriously because the blog followers continue to increase. Messages from sexual violence victims increased even more. I believe that I did something good, but it should not stop after the arrest of just one person. It should not stop because there are still a lot of girls and victims who could not believe that people have started speaking out and that things are being taken seriously.
Thanks to Emma McCarthy of Reuters for that report. This is VOA. Britain's foreign minister said Thursday that negotiations on a trade deal with the European Union will reach a moment of finality this weekend, with both sides assessing chances of an agreement as slim. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson held a three-hour dinner meeting Wednesday in hopes of unblocking stalled talks, but came away saying the gaps between them were large. They told their negotiators to keep talking, but set Sunday as decision day. A suspected COVID-19 case aboard a so-called cruise to nowhere from Singapore was a false alarm, the government said Thursday. The suspected case forced the ship to return to dock, and nearly 17,000 guests had to isolate. Passengers on Royal Caribbean's Quantum of the Seas vessel were held in their cabins for more than 16 hours Wednesday after an 83-year-old man tested positive for COVID-19 when he sought medical help for diarrhea. But Singapore's health ministry says the man did not have the virus after three subsequent tests on land came back negative. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Yesterday, it was announced that The Voice of America will have a new director. VOA's parent agency, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, or USAGM, said that former VOA director Robert Riley would return to lead the network. Riley served as VOA director for about a year following the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks on the U.S. He is the first permanent director to be appointed by USAGM CEO Michael Pack. USAGM has not stated when Riley will start as director. In a press release Wednesday, Pack said, quote, "Riley's inimitable experience and proven leadership as both a public servant and a private citizen will greatly benefit the entire agency," end quote. However, Republican and Democratic lawmakers criticized Pack's decision to appoint Riley as VOA director. Representative Michael McCaul of Texas, a lead Republican on the Foreign Affairs Committee, pointed out that Pack has still not appeared appeared before the committee to answer questions on his actions since becoming CEO. The committee issued a subpoena for Pack in September when he canceled his scheduled testimony. Elliot Engel, a Democrat from New York who heads the House Foreign Affairs Committee, referenced Riley's apparent anti-LGBTQ views and described his appointment as a, quote, disgrace and an embarrassment, end quote. The transition team for President-elect Joe Biden declined VOA's request for comment. What might a Biden presidency mean for press freedom in the U.S. and around the world? To find out, I reached out to Nora Benavidez, who is the director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at Free Press Watchdog PEN America in New York. Nora, thank you so much for joining us. Before we get into Biden's administration, let's start by looking back over the past 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency. What has press freedom been like in the U.S. during the Trump administration?
Well, it hasn't been great. I feel like we've been on the defensive for the last 4 years. Journalists themselves had to grapple with how to cover a president that denigrated the entire industry. And frankly, the tone that he set trickled down throughout the country and I think throughout the world. And so we were constantly, you know, as a free expression organization and as an organization committed to protecting journalists, at PEN America, we were just on guard every day. I would say there were some days where even hour by hour, we would hear updates about, you know, Donald Trump's efforts to limit press access at the White House, his online harassment of journalists, you know, on his social media feeds. And so it just was a constant deluge in which the interests of the media and frankly, the public's ability to know what is happening was a constant struggle.
Now, before this interview, we reported on some changes here at VOA, and I'm interested in your take on the controversies that have taken place at VOA surrounding Trump's appointee, Michael Pack, who is now leading VOA's parent organization, the U.S. AGM.
One of the recurring themes that we've seen during the Donald Trump presidency is when he dislikes a journalist, let's say, he will use the press secretary, the White House, any other forms of force that are more formal government mechanisms to exact reprisals against that journalist he dislikes. With VOA, I feel like, you know, the situation and the circumstances we have seen are really similar. The political appointee that he put in place began to exact reprisals against leading authorities in the agency simply based on those types of personal whims. It undermines the agency's ability to feel independent, to actually come across as independent to its readers.
Now, Michael Pack has come out quite clearly that he views this differently, that he views his role as the head of VOA's parent agency, USAGM, as having the right to involve itself in VOA's journalism. He views it as his role to clean up or to fix up USAGM and VOA. He says the agency has low morale, and the administration has also criticized VOA for what it says is not, in their view, representing the views or the priorities of the U.S. government. So how would you and your organization, PEN America, respond to their position?
Well, I remember when some of this news started coming out, and part of what was, you know, being characterized was that various employees needed to be investigated for, quote unquote, bias. And that is just a very classic way of undercutting the role of a free press, being able to allow leaders to shroud themselves in cover and to be able then to evade accountability. So hearing Michael Pack's language, it really falls in line with so much of those types of tactics, just trying to undermine what we would normally see as an independent agency able to do its job.
Now, looking ahead to Biden's presidency, what do you think press freedom will look like under a Biden administration, in particular because when Biden was vice president under Obama, their administration was pretty heavily criticized for how they dealt with the press?
I mean, I think that's honestly such a great question, and it's really important to be vigilant and have a kind of very candid historical view of what previous presidents have done. Though I still believe over and over again that the Trump administration was uniquely bad and antagonistic towards the press. You know, first and foremost, I'm just relieved to think that the rule of law may be something that a Biden-Harris administration returns to. From there, I think there are going to be really important both rhetoric and concrete steps that the administration needs to take. One is through reinstating regular press briefings and making some kind of relationship with the press corps again that is not built on denigrating them, yelling at them, kicking people out of press briefings. And then I think that there are other efforts that the Biden administration will have to do abroad to begin to repair the damage that has been done over the last 4 years, in which other countries also see the United States no longer as a leader when it comes to principles around free expression, press freedom, when our, you know, rankings as a country have just slowly gone down and down, given the number of physical, digital, and rhetorical attacks on journalists.
I just want to hammer home one point here. In the Obama-Biden administration, there was a lot of criticism at the time on how their administration went after leaks. And of course, leaks are a vital part of how the press informs the public about governments anywhere in the world, getting that information from anonymous sources and sharing it with the public. Are you concerned that a Biden administration might try to clamp down on leaks within its administration the way that the Obama administration did?
I think we're just going to have to see. And this is where the media freedom and the press freedom community is going to have to be vigilant in watching what the Biden administration does in its early days. If there are even small murmurs of these types of concerns, I think that's where the accountability from our community is going to have to come in strong and fast. Because whatever happens in those early days can absolutely, as we saw with Donald Trump, permeate the next 4 years.
That's Nora Benavidez, Director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at Free Press Watchdog PEN America in New York. Nora, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
The Minneapolis City Council unanimously approved a budget early Thursday that will shift about $8 million from the police department toward violence prevention and other programs, but it will keep the mayor's targeted staffing levels for sworn officers intact. The move is the latest development in a six-month battle over the fate of the city's police department following the death of a black man, George Floyd, while in police custody back in May. Floyd's death sparked massive protests across the United States demanding an end to racism and police brutality. The protests also called for portions of budgets to be taken away from police departments to fund health, housing, and other social services. Shortly after the protests began, Minneapolis's city council voted to disband the city's police department, but that move was later walked back. Researchers believe they have found a previously unknown species of beaked whale in waters off Mexico's western coast. If confirmed, the new species would mark a significant discovery among giant mammals. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
A group of researchers that set out to sea around Mexico's western coast last month spotted three unusual animals below the surface. They looked like giant mammals and only popped up to the surface briefly. But the scientists were quick enough to snap some photos. They didn't realize at the time that they were looking at what may be an undiscovered species of beaked whales. Jay Barlow, a marine mammal biologist, described the encounter.
We saw something new, something that was not expected in this area, something that doesn't match, either visually or acoustically, anything that's known to exist.
When Barlow and his colleagues studied their photos, they noticed that the whale's teeth were unusually placed. Underwater recordings also suggested the whale's calls were unique. The beaked whales, named for their pointy, dolphin-like snouts, can reach up to 5 meters long, but can be hard for scientists to observe as they tend to swim and feed mostly at depths of around 3,000 feet. The animals stay at these depths as they have a better chance of avoiding their main predator, killer whales.
They investigated the hydrophone that we put in the water. It was the most amazing encounter of beaked whales that I've ever had.
The scientists with the non-profit Sea Shepherd Conservation Society are now awaiting the analysis of water samples that could hold skin cells for possible DNA testing to confirm whether the whales are a new species. The mammals were spotted near the remote San Benito Islands, about 300 miles south of the U.S. border. If confirmed, this discovery would bring the number of known beaked whale species to 24.
That was Libby Hogan of Reuters, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our editor, Keith Wallace, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.